the bus windows, I realized just how much I owed Ms. Bailey and J.T. If it weren't for the two of them, and a few other people like C-Note and Autry, I wouldn't ever have made any progress in learning how things really worked around Robert Taylor. I spent the next few weeks turning the information in my notebooks into statistical tables and graphs that showed how much different hustlers made. I figured that J.T. would appreciate this data at least as much as my professors would, since he was always talking about the importance of data analysis within his managerial technique. So I headed over to Robert Taylor to show him my research. In the parking lot, I ran into C-Note, who was in his usual spot with a few other squatters, fixing flat tires and washing cars. "Hey, what's up, guys?" I shouted out. "Long time. How you been?" Nobody replied. They looked at me, then turned away. I walked closer and stood a few feet from them. "What's up?" I said. "Everything all right?" One of the men, Pooty, picked up a tool and started to loosen a tire from the rim. "Man, sometimes you just learn the hard way," he said to no one in particular. "That's life, isn't it? Sometimes you realize you can't trust nobody. They could be a cop, a snitch, who knows?" C-Note simply shrugged. "Mm-hmm," he said. "Yep, you just learn you can't trust nobody," Pooty continued. "You tell them something, and then they turn on you, just like that. You can't predict it, especially if they're not from around here." Once again, C-Note shrugged. "Mm-hmm," he muttered. "You got that right." They kept ignoring me, so I walked over to JT's building. A young woman I knew named Keisha was standing on the grass with her kids. They looked like they were waiting for a ride. "Hey, Keisha," I said. "How you doing?" "How am I doing?" she asked, shaking her head. "I was doing a lot better before I started talking to you." She picked up her things and walked her kids a few yards away. In the lobby, some of JT's gang members were hanging out. We shook hands and said hello. I went upstairs to see Ms. Bailey and JT, but neither of them was home. Down in the lobby again, I could feel people staring at me, but I couldn't figure out why. I felt myself growing paranoid. Did people suddenly think I was a cop? What was up with Pooty, C-Note, and Keisha? I decided to go back home. I spent a few days trying to track down JT, but nobody knew where he was. I couldn't wait any longer, so I went back to Robert Taylor and found C-Note in the parking lot. He and two other men were working on a car. "C-Note, please," I begged. "What did I do? Tell me." C-Note stood up and wiped the oil off a wrench. He motioned for the two other men to leave us alone. One of them gave me a nasty look and muttered something that sounded equally nasty, but I couldn't quite make it out. "You need to learn to shut your mouth," C-Note finally said. "Shut my mouth? I don't know what you're talking about." "Don't play with me. All that shit I told you, all them niggers I introduced you to, if you told me you were going to tell JT they were making that money, I wouldn't have told you nothing." My heart sank. I thought of my long debriefing with JT and Ms. Bailey. I had given them breakdowns on each hustler's earnings. How much every one of them made, when and where they worked, what they planned for the future. I didn't hand over my written data, but I'd done the next best thing. "JT is all over these niggers," C-Note said. He looked disgusted and spit on the ground. I could tell he was angry, but that he wasn't comfortable expressing it to me. Until now, our relationship had been based on trust. I rarely, if ever, spoke to anyone about what I learned from C-Note. "He's taxing every one of them now," he said, "and he beat the shit out of Parnell and his brother because he thought they were hiding what they were doing. They weren't, but you can't convince JT of nothing. When he gets his mind to something, that's it. And then he tells JoJo and his guys that they can't come around no more because they were hiding things from him. JoJo's daughter lives up in here, so now he can't see her." C-Note kept talking, getting angrier and angrier as he listed all the people that JT was cracking down on. "There's no way he could have found out if you didn't say nothing." There was an awkward silence. I thought about lying and began to drum up an excuse, but something came over me. During the years I'd been in this community, people were always telling me that I was different from all the journalists and other outsiders who came by, hunting up stories. They didn't eat dinner with families or hang around at night to share a beer. They typically asked a lot of questions and then left with their story, never to return. I prided myself on this difference. But now it was time to accept my fate. I was sitting in Miss Bailey's office, I told C-Note. She and JT always helped me, just like you. And I fucked up. I told them things, and I had no idea that they would use that information. Man, I had no idea it would even be useful to them. That has to be one of the stupidest things I ever heard you say. C-Note began putting away his tools. Honestly, C-Note, I had no idea when I was talking to them.
No.
C-Note's voice grew sharp. You knew.
Yes, you did. But you were too busy thinking about your own self. That's what happened. You got some shit for your professors, and you were getting high on that. I know you ain't that naive, man.
I'm sorry, C-Note. I don't know what else to say. I fucked up.
Yeah, you fucked up. You need to think about why you're doing your work. You always tell me you want to help us.
Well, we ain't never asked for your help, and we sure don't need it now. C-Note walked away toward the other men. They stood quietly drinking beer and watching me. I headed toward the building. I wanted to see if Miss Bailey was in her office. Then an obvious thought hit me. If JT had acted on my information to tax the male street hustlers, Miss Bailey might have started taxing the women I told her about. Worse yet, she might have had some of them evicted for hiding their income. How could I find out what had happened because of my stupidity? As I stood in the grassy expanse, staring up at the high-rise, I tried to think of someone who might possibly help me. I needed a tenant who was relatively independent of Miss Bailey, someone who might still trust me enough to talk. I thought of Clarice. I hustled over to the liquor store and bought a few bottles of Boone's Farm wine. Clarice wasn't going to talk for free. I walked quickly through the building lobby and took the stairs up. I didn't want to get trapped in the elevator with women who might be angry with me for selling them out to Miss Bailey. Clarice opened her door and greeted me with a loud burst of laughter.
Cool, boy, you fucked up this time, you surely did.
So it's all over the building? Everyone knows?
Sweetheart, there ain't no secrets in this place. What did Clarice tell you when we first met? Shut the fuck up. Don't tell them nothing about who you are and what you do. Clarice should have been there with you. You were spying for Miss Bailey?
Spying? No way, I wasn't spying. I was just doing my research, asking questions and...
Sweetheart, it don't matter what you call it. Miss Bailey got pissed off and went running up in people's houses, claiming they owed her money. I mean, you probably doubled her income, just like that. And you're really not getting any kickbacks? Just a little something from her?
Wait a minute, I said. How do they know I was the one who gave Miss Bailey the information?
Because, you fool, she told everyone. Even if she didn't tell them, she was running around saying, you made $25 last month, you made $50 last week, you made $10 this week, and you owe me 10% plus a penalty for not telling me. I mean, the only folks we told all this information to was you.
But did she charge you, too?
No, no, she don't charge the hoes, remember? JT already charges us.
I sat and listened with my head down as Clarice listed all the women who'd been confronted by Miss Bailey. I had a sinking feeling that I'd have a hard time coming back to this building to continue my research. I also had to face the small matter of managing to leave here today still in one piece. Clarice sensed my anxiety. As she talked, laughing heartily all the while, at my expense, she started massaging my shoulder.
"Don't worry, little baby. You probably never had an ass-whooping, have you? Well, sometimes that helps clear the air. Just don't take the stairs when you leave, because if you get caught there, they may never find your body."
I must have looked truly frightened, for Clarice stopped laughing and took a sincere tone.
"Folks forgive around here," she said gently. "We're all religious people, sweetheart. We have to put up with a lot of shit from our own families, so nothing you did to us will make things much worse."
At that moment, sitting with Clarice, I didn't think that even the good Lord himself could, or would, help me. It was embarrassing to think that I had been so wrapped up in my desire to obtain good data that I couldn't anticipate the consequences of my actions. After several years in the projects, I had become attuned to each and every opportunity to get information from the tenants. This obsession was primarily fueled by a desire to make my dissertation stand out and increase my stature in the eyes of my advisors. After I'd talked with C-Note and Clarice, it was clear to me that other people were paying a price for my success. I began to feel deeply ambivalent about my own reasons for being in the projects. Would I really advance society with my research, as Bill Wilson had promised I could do if I worked hard? Could I change our stereotypes of the poor by getting so deep inside the lives of the families? I suddenly felt deluged by these kinds of questions. Looking back, I was probably being a little melodramatic. I had been so naive up to this point about how others perceived my presence that any sort of shake-up at all was bound to send me reeling. I couldn't think of a way to rectify the situation other than to stop coming to Robert Taylor entirely, but I was close to finishing my fieldwork, and I didn't want to quit prematurely. In the coming weeks, I spoke to Clarice and Autry a few times for advice. Both suggested that the tenants I had angered would eventually stop being so angry, but they couldn't promise much more than that. When I asked Autry whether I'd be able to get back to collecting data, he just shrugged and walked off. I eventually came back to the building to face the tenants. No one declined to speak with me outright, but I didn't exactly receive a hero's welcome either. Everyone knew I had JT's support, so it was unlikely that anyone would confront me in a hostile manner. When I went to visit C-Note in the parking lot, he simply nodded at me and then went about his work, talking with customers and singing along with the radio. It felt like people in the building looked at me strangely when I passed by, but I wondered if I was just being paranoid. Perhaps the best indicator of my change in status was that I wasn't doing much of anything casual, hearing jokes, sharing a beer, loaning someone a dollar. One sultry summer day, not long after my fiasco with the hustlers, I attended the funeral of Katrina, Ms. Bailey's dutiful assistant. On the printed announcement, her full name was rendered as Katrina Eugenia Washington. But I knew this was not her real name. Katrina had once told me that her father had sexually abused her when she was a teenager, so she ran away from home. She wound up living in Robert Taylor with a distant relative. She changed her name so that her father wouldn't find her and enrolled in a GED program at DuSable High School. She took a few part-time jobs to help pay for rent and groceries. She was also saving money to go to community college. She was trying to start over. I never did find out her real name. As a kid, she had wanted to study math, but her father, she told me, said that higher education was inappropriate for a young black woman. He advised her instead just to get married and have children. Katrina had a love of knowledge and would participate in a discussion about nearly anything. I enjoyed talking with her about science, African American history, and Chicago politics. She always wore a studious look, intense and focused. Working as Ms. Bailey's assistant, she received just a few dollars a week. But far more significant, she was receiving an apprenticeship in Chicago politics. "I will do something important one day," she liked to tell me in her most serious voice. "Like Ms. Bailey, I will make a difference for black people, especially black women." By this time, Katrina had been living in Robert Taylor for a few years, but over the July 4th holiday, she decided to visit her siblings in Chicago's south suburbs, an area increasingly populated with African-American families who'd made it out of the ghetto. From what I was told, her father heard that she was visiting and tracked her down. A skirmish followed. Katrina got caught between her brother, who was protecting her, and her angry father. A gun went off, and the bullet hit Katrina, killing her instantly. No one around Robert Taylor knew if either the brother or the father had been arrested. The funeral was held in the back room of a large African Methodist Episcopal church on the grounds of Robert Taylor. The hot air was stifling, the sun streaming in shafts through dusty windows. There were perhaps 50 people in attendance, mostly women from Ms. Bailey's building. A few members of Katrina's family were also there, but they came surreptitiously because they didn't want her father to hear about the funeral. Ms. Bailey stationed herself at the room's entrance, welcoming the mourners. She looked as if she were presiding over a tenant meeting, upright, authoritarian, refusing to cry while consoling those who were. She had the air of someone who did this regularly, who mourned for someone every week. Sitting in a corner up front was T-Bone, his head down, still as stone. He and Katrina had been seeing each other for a few months. Although T-Bone had a steady girlfriend, it wasn't uncommon for gang members, or practically any other young man in the projects, to have multiple girlfriends. He and Katrina had struck up a friendship and, over time, become lovers. I sometimes came upon the two of them studying together at a local diner. T-Bone was about to leave his girlfriend for Katrina when she was killed. Any loss of life is mourned in the projects, but there are degrees. Young men and women who choose a life of drugs and street gangs may, understandably, not be long for this world. When one of them dies, he or she is certainly mourned, but without any great sense of shock. There is a general feeling that death was always a good possibility. But for someone like Katrina, who had refused to follow such a path, death came with a deep sense of shock and disbelief. She was one of the thousands of young people who had escaped the attention of social workers, the police, and just about everyone else. Adults in the projects pile up their hopes on people like Katrina, young men and women who take a sincere interest in education, work, and self-betterment. And I guess I did too. Her death left me with a sting that would never fade. The essays that Katrina used to write covered the difficulties of family life in the projects, the need for women to be independent, the stereotypes about poor people. Writing seemed to provide Katrina a sense of relief, as though she were finally acknowledging the hurdles of her own past. It also helped her develop a strong, assertive voice, not unlike that of her hero, Ms. Bailey. In tribute to Katrina, I thought I'd try to broaden this idea by starting a writing workshop for young women in the building who were interested in going back to school. I brought up the possibility with Ms. Bailey.
"Good idea," she said, "but take it slow, especially when you're dealing with these young women."
I was nervous about teaching the workshop, but I was also eager. My relationship with tenants up to this point had largely been a one-way street. After all this time in Robert Taylor, I felt as though I should give something back. On a few occasions, I had managed to solicit donations from my professors, $50 or $100, for some kind of program in the neighborhood. This money might do a great deal of good, but it seemed to me a fairly impersonal way of helping. I was hoping to do something more direct. In the past, I hadn't been drawn to standard charitable activities like coaching basketball or volunteering at a school because I wanted to differentiate myself from the people who helped families and ran programs in the community. I had heard many tenants criticize the patronizing attitudes of such volunteers. The writing workshop, however, seemed like a good fit. Having hung out in the community for several years, I believed I could avoid the kind of fate, exclusion, cold stares, condescending responses that often greeted the people who rode into town to do good. I was also still reeling from the fact that I had alienated so many people around JT's territory. I was feeling guilty, and I needed to get people back on my side again. Of all the people in the projects, I had the least experience spending time with young women, particularly single mothers. I was a bit nervous, particularly because Ms. Bailey, Ms. May, and other older women warned me not to get too close to the young women. They felt that the women would begin looking at me as a source of support. In the beginning, the group convened wherever we could, in someone's apartment, at a diner, outside under a tree. At first, there were 5 women in the group. And then we grew to roughly a dozen as more people heard about it. The meetings were pretty casual, and attendance could be spotty since the women had family and work obligations. From the outset, it was an emotional experience. The women wrote and spoke openly about their struggles. Each of them had at least a couple of children, which generally meant at least one baby daddy who wasn't in the picture. Each of them had a man in her life who'd been either jailed or killed. They spoke of in-laws who demanded that the women give up their children to the father's family, some of whom were willing to use physical force to claim the children. Their material hardships were overwhelming. Most of them earned no more than $10,000 a year, a combination of welfare payments and food stamps. Some worked part-time, and others took in boarders who paid cash, or, nearly as valuable, provided daycare so the young women could work, run errands, or just have a little time for themselves. The most forceful stories were the tales of abuse. Every single woman had been beaten up by a boyfriend, who was usually drunk at the time, some almost fatally. Every one of them had lived in fear for days or weeks, waiting for the same man to return. One cold autumn evening, we congregated at a local diner. We found a large table in the back, where it was quiet. The owner was by now accustomed to our presence, and he didn't mind that we stayed for hours. If business was particularly good, he'd feed us all night long, and then waive the tab. He and I had struck up a friendship. I often came to the diner to write up my field notes, and he liked the fact that I was trying to help tenants. The theme of this week's essay was How I Survive. Tanya was the first to read from her journal. She was 20 years old, a high school dropout with two children. She'd stayed with her mother after the first child was born, but eventually got her own apartment in the same building, then had a second baby. She didn't know the whereabouts of the first father. The second had died in a gang shooting. In her essay, she bragged about how she earned twice her welfare income by taking in boarders. "But sometimes it doesn't go so well, Sue dear," said one of the other women, Serena, who liked to be the voice of reason. She stared down Tanya as she spoke. Serena had three children, the fathers of whom were respectively in jail, dead, and unwilling to pay child support. So she, too, had taken in boarders. "I remember when my brother came into the house. He started dealing dope, and they caught him, almost took my lease away."
"Yeah, but that's because you didn't pay the building manager enough money," Tanya said. "Or I think it was because you didn't sleep with him."
"Well, I'm not doing either one of those things," Serena said in a moralistic tone, shaking her head.
"You got some nerve," interrupted Keisha. "Serena, you put your ass out there for any man who comes looking."
At 26, Keisha was one of the oldest women in the group. Even though she had grown angry with me for sharing information about hustlers with Ms. Bailey, she hadn't held the grudge for long. She had two daughters and was the best writer in the group, a high school graduate now planning to apply to Roosevelt College.
"Hell, there ain't no difference between some hoe selling her shit and you taking some man in your house for money."
"Hey, that's survival," Tanya said. "I mean, that's what we're here to talk about, right?"
"Okay," I jumped in, trying to establish some order. "What's the best way for you to take care of whatever you need to? Give me the top 10 ways you survive." Serena began. "Always make sure you know someone at the CHA you can turn to when you can't make rent. It helps, because you could get evicted."
"Yeah, and if you have to sleep with a nigger downtown, then you got to do it," said Keisha. "Because if you don't, they will put your kids on the street."
Serena went on, ignoring Keisha.
"You got to make sure you can get clothes and food and diapers for your kids," she said, "even if you don't have money. So you need to have good relations with stores."
"Make sure Miss Bailey's always getting some dick," Keisha shouted, laughing hard.
"You know, one time I had to let her sleep with my man so I wouldn't get kicked out of the building," Chantel said.
"That's awful," I said.
"Yeah," Chantel said, "and he almost left me, too, when he found out that Miss Bailey could get him a job and would let him stay up there and eat all her food."
Chantel was 21. Her son had learning disabilities, so she was struggling to find a school that could help him. She worked part-time at a fast-food restaurant and depended on her mother and grandmother for daycare and cash. Chantel's hardships weren't uncommon in the projects. Unfortunately, neither was her need to appease Ms. Bailey. The thought that a tenant had to let the building president sleep with her partner was alarming to me. But among these women, such indignities weren't rare.
To keep your own household intact, they said, you had to keep Ms. Bailey happy and well paid. As I heard more stories similar to Chantel's, I found myself growing angry at Ms. Bailey and the other LAC officials. I asked Chantel and the other women why they didn't challenge Ms. Bailey. Their answer made perfect sense. When it became obvious that the housing authority supported a management system based on extortion and corruption, the women decided their best option was to shrug their shoulders and accept their fate. I found it unconscionable that such a regime existed, but I wasn't going to confront Ms. Bailey either. She was too powerful. And so while the women's anger turned into despair, my disgust began to morph into bitterness. The women's list of survival techniques went well beyond 10. Keep cigarettes in your apartment so you can pay off a squatter to fix things when they break. Let your child pee in the stairwell to keep prostitutes from congregating there at night. Let the gangs pay you to store drugs and cash in your apartment. The risk of apprehension, the women concurred, was slim. Then there were all the resources to be procured in exchange for sex. Groceries from the bodega owner, rent forgiveness from the CHA, assistance from a welfare bureaucrat, preferential treatment from a police officer for a jailed relative. The women's explanation for using sex as currency was consistent and pragmatic. If your child was in danger of going hungry, then you did whatever it took to fix the problem. The women looked pained when they discussed using their bodies to obtain these necessities. It was clear that this wasn't their first or even their 100th preference. "Always know somebody at the hospital," Tanya blurted out. "Always have somebody you can call, because that ambulance never comes. And when you get there, you need to pay somebody, or else you'll be waiting in line forever." "Yes, that's true, and the people at the hospital can give you free baby food," Serena said. "Usually you need to meet them in the back alley." "And I'd say you should keep a gun or a knife hidden in case your man starts beating you. Because sometimes you have to do something to get him to stop." "You've had to use a knife before?" I asked. No one had spoken or written about this yet. "How often?" "Many times." Serena looked at me as if I'd grown up on Mars. "When these men start drinking, you can't talk to them. You just need to protect yourself. And don't forget, they'll beat up the kids too." Keisha started to cry. She dropped her head into her lap and covered up so no one could see. Serena leaned over and hugged her. "The easiest time is when they're asleep," Tanya said. "They're lying there mostly because they've passed out drunk. That's when it runs through your mind. You start thinking, I could end it right here. I could kill the motherfucker right now. Then he can't beat me no more. I think about it a lot." Keisha wiped her eyes. "I stabbed that nigger because I couldn't take it no more. Wasn't anybody helping me. Miss Bailey said she couldn't do nothing. The police said they couldn't do nothing. And this man was coming around beating me and beating my baby for no reason. I couldn't think of any other way. Couldn't think of nothing else to do." She began to sob again. Serena escorted her to the bathroom. "She sent her man to the hospital," Tanya quietly explained. "Almost killed him. One night he was asleep on the couch. He had already sent her to the hospital a few times, broke her ribs. She got stitches and bruises all over her body. She grabbed that knife and kept putting it in his stomach. He got up and ran out of the apartment. I think one of JT's boys took him to the hospital. He's a BK. Because the boyfriend was a senior gang member, Tanya said, JT refused to pressure him to stop beating Keisha. She still lived in fear that the man would return. One day Ms. Bailey called and asked that I come to a building-wide meeting with her tenants. She hadn't invited me to such a meeting in more than a year, so I figured something important was afoot. I hadn't been keeping up with Ms. Bailey's tenant meetings in part because I'd already amassed sufficient information on these gatherings, and also because, in all honesty, I'd grown uncomfortable watching the horse-trading schemes that she and other tenant leaders used to manage the community. My own life was starting to evolve. I had moved in with my girlfriend, Cation, and we were thinking about getting married. Visiting our relatives, mine in California and hers in Montana, took time away from my fieldwork, including much of our summers and vacations. My parents were thrilled, and they pushed me to think seriously about starting a family along with a career. Cation was applying to law school. Neither of us was ready for children just yet. And then there was the matter of my dissertation, which I still had to write. I began to meet more regularly with Bill Wilson and other advisors to see whether I could plausibly move toward wrapping up my graduate study. Ms. Bailey's office was packed for the meeting when I arrived, with a few dozen people in attendance, all talking excitedly. As usual, most of them were older women, but there were also several men standing in back. I recognized a couple of them as the partners of the women in the building. It was unusual to see these men at a public meeting. Ms. Bailey waved me up front, pointing me to the chair next to hers.
"Okay," she said. "Sudhir has agreed to come here today so we can clear this up."
I was taken aback. Clear what up? Everyone was suddenly staring at me, and they didn't look happy.
"Why are you sleeping with my daughter?" shouted a woman I didn't recognize. "Tell me, goddammit, why are you fucking my baby?"
"Answer the woman,"
someone else hollered. I couldn't tell who was talking, but it didn't matter. I was in a state of shock. One man, addressing me as Arab, told me that I should get out of the neighborhood for good and especially leave alone their young women. Other people joined in.
"Nigger, get out of here. Arab, go home. Get the fuck out, Julio."
Ms. Bailey tried to restore order. Amid the shouting, she yelled out that I would explain myself. I was still confused.
"Let Sudhir tell you why he's meeting them," Ms. Bailey said, and then I understood.
It was the writing workshop. People had seen me picking up the young women and driving away with them. Apparently they thought I was sleeping with them, or maybe pimping them out. As I tried to explain the writing workshop, I kept getting drowned out. I began to feel scared. I'd seen how a mob of tenants nearly tore apart the Middle Eastern shopkeeper who'd slept with Boo Boo's daughter.
Ms. Bailey finally made herself heard above the riot. "He's trying to tell you that he's just helping them with homework."
That quieted everyone down a little bit. But still, I was stung. Why weren't any of the women from the workshop in attendance? Why hadn't anyone come to defend me, to tell the truth? After a few more minutes, things having calmed down a bit, Ms. Bailey told me to leave. There was other business to take care of, she said, laughing at me and clearly enjoying herself at my expense. Leaving the building that night, I wondered how much more time I could afford to spend in JT's territory. It was hard to think of any tenants who weren't angry with me.
Chapter 7. Black and Blue.
Of all the relationships I'd developed during my time at Robert Taylor, it turned out that the strongest one by far was my bond with JT. As unusual and as morally murky as this relationship may have been, it was also undeniably powerful. Our years together had produced a close relationship. This bond would become even more intimate, to the point that JT felt personally indebted to me when I had the opportunity to help save the life of one of his closest friends. It was a classic Chicago summer afternoon. A cloudless sky, the muggy air broken occasionally by a soft lake breeze. I was hanging around at Robert Taylor outside JT's building, along with perhaps 100 other people. Tenants were barbecuing, playing softball, and taking comfort in the cool shadow of the building. Few apartments had a working air conditioner, so on a day like this, the lawn got more and more crowded as the day wore on. I was sitting on the lawn next to Daryl Young, one of JT's uncles, who relaxed on a lawn chair with a six-pack of beer. Since the beer was warm, Daryl sent a niece or nephew inside every now and then to fetch some ice for his cup. Daryl was in his late 40s and had long ago lost most of his teeth. He had unkempt salt-and-pepper hair, walked with a stiff limp, and always wore his State of Illinois ID on a chain around his neck. He left the project grounds so rarely that his friends called him a lifer. He knew every inch of Robert Taylor, and he loved to tell stories about the most dramatic police busts and the most memorable baseball games between competing buildings. He told me about the project's famous pimps and infamous murderers, as well as about one tenant who tried to raise a tiger in his apartment, and another who kept 100 snakes in her apartment until the day she let them loose in the building. Suddenly Daryl sat up, staring at an old beater of a Ford sedan cruising slowly past the building. The driver was a young white man, looking up at the building as if he expected someone to come down.
"Get the fuck out of here, boy!" Daryl shouted. "We don't need you round here!"
Go and sleep with your own women.
Daryl turned and hollered to a teenage boy playing basketball nearby.
Cheetah, go and get Price. Tell him to come here.
Why do you want Price? I asked.
Price is the only one who can take care of this, Daryl said. His face was tight, and he kept his eyes on the Ford.
By now the car had come to a stop.
Take care of what? I asked. Damned white boys come around here for our women, Daryl said. It's disgusting. This ain't no goddamn brothel.
You think he's a John?
I know he's a John, Daryl said, scowling, and then went back to shouting at the Ford. Boy! Hey, boy, get on home! We don't want your money!
Price sauntered out of the building, trailed by a few other members of the BK security squad. Daryl stood up and hobbled over to Price.
Get that boy out of here, Price, he said. I'm tired of them coming around here. This ain't no goddamn whorehouse.
All right, old man, Price said, irritated by Daryl's enthusiasm, but clearly a bit concerned. Don't worry, we'll take care of him. Price and his entourage approached the car. I could hear Price speaking gruffly to the driver while the other BKs surrounded the car so that it couldn't drive off. Then Price opened the door and gestured for the white guy to get out. Just then I heard the loud squeal of a car rounding the corner of 25th and Federal. Some kids shouted at people to get out of its path. It was a gray sedan, and I could see it roaring toward us, but unsteadily, as if one of the wheels were loose. The first shots sounded like machine gun fire. Everyone seemed to duck instinctively, except for me. I was frozen upright. My legs were stuck in place and everything turned to slow motion. The car came closer. Price and the other BK security men ran toward the building as more shots were fired. The car flew past, and I could see four people inside, all black. It looked as if two of them were shooting, one from either side. Price got hit and dropped to the ground. The rest of his entourage reached the lobby safely. Price wasn't moving. I saw Daryl lying flat on the grass while other tenants were crawling toward shelter. A car, a tree, the building itself, and grabbing children as they went. I was still standing, in shock, though I had managed at least to hunch over. The gray car had vanished. Then I heard a second car screeching down the back alleyway. I was puzzled. In most drive-by shootings, a gang wouldn't risk a second pass, since the element of surprise had been used up. Indeed, looking around now at the expanse in front of the building, I saw perhaps a dozen young men with guns in their hands, crouching behind cars or along the sides of the building. I had never seen so many guns in Robert Taylor. Price still hadn't gotten up. I could see that he was gripping his leg. Somehow the sight of him lying motionless moved me to action. I headed toward him and saw that one of the BKs had come back outside to do the same. We grabbed Price and started to drag him toward the building.
"Get Serena! Get Serena!"
someone shouted down from an upper floor. "She's out there with her baby!" The BK helping me with Price ran over to help Serena and her children to a safe spot. I dragged Price the rest of the way by myself and made it to the lobby just as the second car emerged from the alley. I heard some shouts and some more gunshots. I saw that the BK who'd gone to help Serena had draped his body atop her and her kids. In the dim light of the lobby, I could see that Price's leg was bleeding badly, just above the knee. JT's men pushed me out of the way. They carried Price farther inside the building toward one of the ground floor apartments. I wondered where JT was.
Sudhir, get inside and go upstairs to Ms. Mays, now!
It was Miss Bailey. I gestured toward Price to show that I wanted to help. She just yelled at me again to get upstairs. About five flights up the stairs, I ran into a group of JT's men on the gallery, looking out.
"I don't see no more,"
one of them shouted to some BKs on the ground outside.
"It don't look like there's any more. Just get everyone inside and put four in the lobby."
I heard a stream of footsteps in the stairwell. Parents yelled at their children to hurry up, and a few mothers asked for help carrying their strollers. I heard someone say that JT was in the lobby, so I hustled back downstairs. He stood at the center of a small mob, taking reports from his men. There was a lot of commotion, all of them talking past one another.
"Niggers will do it again, I know they will. We need to get Price to the hospital, he's still bleeding. No, we need to secure the building. I say we drive by and shoot back, now."
As instructed, four young men now stood armed guard in the lobby, two at each entrance.
Under normal circumstances, young gang members like these bragged about their toughness, their willingness to kill for the family. But now, with the real danger, they looked shaky, eyes wide and fearful. JT stood calmly, wearing dark sunglasses, picking his teeth. When his eyes fell upon me, he fixed me with a glare. I didn't know what he was trying to communicate. Then he pointed toward the ceiling. He wanted me upstairs, at his mother's place, out of the way. Instead, I walked even farther into the lobby, out of his view. I asked a rank-and-file BK where Price was. He pointed down the hall. JT approached, patted me on the back, and pulled me in close. "Price isn't doing so hot," he whispered. "He's bleeding real bad, and I need to get him to the hospital." "Call the ambulance," I said instinctively. "They won't come. Listen, we need your car. If they see one of our cars come up to Provident, they may call the police. We need to borrow your car."
"Sure, of course," I said, reaching for my keys.
I had recently bought a Junker, a 1982 Cutlass Sierra. "Let me get it." "No," JT said, grabbing my hand. "You can't leave the building for a while. Go upstairs, but let me have the keys. Charisse will take him." I gave JT my keys and watched him walk toward the apartment where Price was being looked after. It was common practice to have a woman drive a BK to the hospital so that he wouldn't immediately be tagged as a gangster. Charisse lived in the building and let the Black Kings use her apartment to make crack cocaine. JT sometimes joked that the young women in the projects would never turn on their stoves if it weren't for his gang cooking up crack. JT commandeered a vacant apartment on the 14th floor to use as a temporary headquarters. The scene was surreal, like watching an army prepare for war. I sat in a corner and watched as JT issued commands. Small groups of men would come inside, receive their orders, and hurry off. JT assigned several men to take up rifles and sit in the windows of the 3rd, 5th, and 7th floors. He instructed other groups of men to go door to door and warned tenants to stay away from the west-facing windows. He told one young BK that there probably wouldn't be another shooting for at least a few hours. "Get some of the older people out of here," he ordered. "Take them up to 2325. A BK foot soldier told me that Price had made it to the emergency room, but was said to be still bleeding badly. JT came over and told me what he knew. The first car, the beat-up Ford, was a decoy to lure some Black Kings out of the building. The attack appeared to be a collaboration between the MCs and the Stones. They were deeply envious, JT told me, that the BKs had been able to attract so many customers to their territory. The MCs and the Stones were a constant source of worry for JT, since they were led by crazy niggers, his term for the kind of bad businessman who thought that a drive-by shooting was the best way to compete in a drug market. JT much preferred the more established rival gangs, since a shared interest in maintaining the status quo decreased their appetite for violence. Every so often, JT sent out an entourage to buy food for people in the building. A few tenants carried on as usual, paying little attention to the Black King's dramatic show of security in the lobby. But except for a couple of stereos and some shouting in the stairwells, the building was eerily quiet. We all baked in the still, hot air. Occasionally, one of JT's more senior members would throw out a plan for retaliation. JT listened to every proposal, but was noncommittal. "We got time for all that," he kept saying. "Let's just see what happens tonight." Every half hour, Charisse called from the hospital to report on Price's condition. JT looked tense as he took these reports. Price was a friend since high school, one of the few people JT allowed in his inner circle. I was just nodding off to sleep on the floor when JT walked over. "Thanks, man," he said quietly. "For what?" "You didn't have to get mixed up in this shit." He must have heard that I'd helped drag Price into the lobby. I didn't say anything. JT slapped my leg, asked if I wanted a Coke, and walked off to the fridge. There were no more shootings that night, but the tension didn't let up. I never went home. Within a few days, once he figured out exactly who was responsible for the attack, JT rounded up T-Bone and several other officers and went after the shooters. JT personally helped beat them up. The BKs also took their guns and money. Because these young rivals had no business sense, as JT told me later, there was no hope of a compromise. Physical retaliation was the only measure to consider. Price stayed in the hospital for a few days, but the bullet caused no irreparable damage, and he was soon back in action. T-Bone called me one day with big news. JT was on the verge of receiving another important promotion within the citywide Black Kings organization. If all went according to plan, JT, T-Bone, and Price would be responsible for taking on even more BK factions, which meant managing a considerably larger drug trafficking operation. I could hear the excitement in T-Bone's voice. For him, too, the promotion meant more money as well as a boost in status.
2 years, that's it, he told me. 2 more years of this shit, and I'm getting out of the game.
Ever practical, T-Bone was saving for his future. A house, full-time college, and a legal job. JT wouldn't be around Robert Taylor much for the next several weeks, T-Bone told me, since his new assignment required a lot of preparation and legwork. But he had asked T-Bone to give me a message.
JT wants you to go with him to the next regional BK meeting. You up for it?
I had been waiting for this phone call for a few years. I desperately wanted to learn about the gang's senior leadership. And now that JT was one of them, it looked like I'd finally have my chance. By this point in my research, I still felt guilty sometimes for being as much of a hustler in my own way as the other hustlers in the neighborhood. C-Note had called me on it, and C-Note was right. I constantly hustled people for information, stories, data, interviews, facts, anything that might make my research more interesting. So I was happy whenever I had the chance to give a little bit back. The writing workshop hadn't worked out as well as I'd wanted, and I was searching for another way to act charitably. An opportunity fell into my lap when the Chicago public school teachers went on strike. Since BK rules stipulated that each member graduate from high school, JT asked Autry to set up a program during the strike so that JT's members could stay off the streets and do some homework. Autry had set up a similar program at the Boys and Girls Club, but gang boundaries forbade JT's members to go there. Autry agreed, and he asked me to run a classroom in JT's building. I obliged, pretty sure that lecturing high schoolers on history, politics, and math shouldn't be too hard. We met in a dingy, darkened apartment with a bathroom that didn't work. On a given day, there were anywhere from 20 to 15 teenage gang members on my watch. The air was so foul that I let them smoke to cover the odor. There weren't enough seats, so the kids forcibly claimed some chairs from neighboring apartments, with no promise of returning them. On the first day, as the students talked loudly through my lecture on history and politics, JT walked in unannounced and shouted at them to pay attention. He ordered Price to take one particularly noisy foot soldier into the hallway and beat him. Later, I asked JT not to interrupt again. The kids would never learn anything, I insisted, if they knew that he was going to be monitoring them. JT and Autry both thought I was crazy. They didn't think I had any chance of controlling the unruly teens without the threat of an occasional visit by JT. They were right. Within a day, the classroom had descended into anarchy. In one corner, a few guys were admiring a gun that one of them had just bought. He was thoughtful enough to remove the bullets during class. In another corner, several teenagers had organized a dice game. The winner would get not only the cash, but also the right to rob the homeless people sleeping in a nearby vacant apartment. One kid brought in a radio and improvised a rap song about their Injun teacher, replete with references to Custer, Geronimo, and the smelly Arab. It never seemed to occur to anyone that Arab and Indian were not in fact interchangeable. In my case, they were equally valuable put-downs. The most harmless kids in the room were the ones who patiently waited for their friends to return from the store with some beer. Things got worse from there. Some of my students started selling marijuana in the classroom. Others would casually leave the building to find a prostitute. When I conveyed all this to JT, he said that as long as the guys showed up, they weren't hanging out on the street and getting into any real trouble. Given that they were using my classroom to deal drugs, gamble, and play with guns, I wondered exactly what JT meant by real trouble. My role was quickly downgraded from teacher to babysitter. The sessions lasted about 2 weeks until news came that the teacher's strike was being settled. By this time, my admiration for Autry's skill with the neighborhood kids had increased exponentially. Despite my utter failure as a teacher, Autry called me again for help. The stakes were a little higher this time, and for me, so was the reward. Autry and the other staffers at the Boys and Girls Club wanted me to help write a grant proposal for the U.S. Department of Justice, which had advertised special funds being allocated for youth programs. The proposal needed to include in-depth crime statistics for the projects and the surrounding neighborhood, data that was typically hard to get since the police didn't like to make such information public. But if I took on the project, I'd get direct access to Officer Reggie Marcus, Officer Reggie to tenants, the local cop who had grown up in Robert Taylor himself and was devoted to making life there better. I jumped at the chance. I had met Reggie on several occasions, but now I had an opportunity to work closely with him and cultivate a genuine friendship. He was about 6 feet tall, as muscular and fit as a football player. He was always dressed well and carried himself with a quiet determination. I knew that Reggie often dealt directly with gang leaders in the hopes of keeping violence to a minimum and that he was a diplomatic force among the project's street hustlers. Now I would be able to ask as many questions as I wanted about the particulars of his work. Why, for instance, did he try to reduce gun violence by making sure that the gangs were the only ones who had guns?
"They don't like gun violence any more than the tenants, because it scares away customers," he explained. "So they try to keep things quiet."
One wintry afternoon, I met Reggie at the police station in the Grand Boulevard neighborhood a few blocks from JT's territory. When I arrived, he told me he still had some phone calls to make, so I went to find a water fountain. The police station was drab, row after row of bland gray cubicles. The air was cold and damp, the tile floor slippery from the tracked-in snow. Near the water fountain, I came upon a wall covered with Polaroid pictures. They were all of black men in their teens and twenties, most of them looking dazed or defiant. Beneath each photo was a caption with the person's name and gang affiliation. Taped next to the photos was a party flyer headlined, "MC Southside Fest." JT's gang hung similar flyers all around the buildings when they were sponsoring a party or a basketball tournament. On the MC flyer there were several names handwritten along the right margin, as if it were a sign-up sheet. Watson, O'Neill, Brown. Reggie came by as I was inspecting the flyer.
"Let's not hang out here," he said, looking concerned. "And let's not talk about that. I'll explain later."
We were heading over to the Boys and Girls Club to talk to Autry about the Department of Justice grant. As we walked to Reggie's SUV parked behind the police station, I was still thinking about the MC flyer. I recalled a party the Black Kings had thrown a few years back, having rented out the second floor of an Elks Lodge. The women were dressed up, and the men wore spiffy tracksuits or pressed jeans. They drank beer and wine coolers, danced, and passed marijuana joints around the room. As JT and I stood talking in a corner, a group of 5 men suddenly busted into the room all dressed in black. One of them held up a gun for everyone to see. The other 4 ran to the corners of the room, one of them shouting for everyone to get up against the wall. 4 of the men were black, 1 white. JT whispered to me, "Cops." He and I took our places against the wall. One of the partying gangsters, a huge man, at least 6'2" and 250 pounds, started to resist.
"Fuck you, nigger," he shouted.
2 of the men in black promptly yanked him into the bathroom, where, from the sound of it, they beat him brutally. We all stood silently against the wall, listening to his grunts and groans.
"Who's next?" shouted one of the men in black. "Who wants some of this?"
2 of them pulled out black trash bags.
"Cash and jewels, I want everything in the bag," one shouted. "Now!"
When the bag reached us, JT calmly deposited his necklace and his money clip, fat with 20s. I put the cash from my pocket, about $15, into the bag. As I did so, the man holding the bag looked up and stared at me. He didn't say anything, but he kept glancing over at me as he continued his collection rounds. He seemed puzzled as to what I, plainly an outsider, was doing there.
When they were done, the five men dropped the bags out the window and calmly filed out. After a time, JT motioned for me to follow him outside. We walked to his car, parked in the adjoining lot. Some other BK leaders joined him, commiserating over the robbery. "Fucking cops do this all the time," JT told me. "As soon as they find out we're having a party, they raid it." "Why? And why don't they arrest you?" I asked. "And how do you know they were cops?"
"It's a game," shouted one of the other BK leaders. "We make all this fucking money, and they want some."
"They're jealous," JT said calmly. "We make more than them, and they can't stand it. So this is how they get back at us." I had a hard time believing that the police would so brazenly rob a street gang. But it didn't seem like the kind of thing that JT would lie about. Most of his exaggerations served the purpose of making him look more powerful, not less so. I had forgotten the incident entirely until I saw the MC flyer at the police station. I wondered if the names written in the margin were the cops who had signed up to raid the party. So I told Reggie about the BK party and JT's claim that the robbers were cops. He took a deep breath and looked straight ahead as he drove.
"You know, Sudhir, you have to be careful about what you hear," he said.
Reggie drove fast, barreling over the unplowed snow as if he were off-roading. Our breath was fogging up the windshield.
"I'm not going to say that all the people I work with are always doing the right thing. Hell, I don't do the right thing all the time, but you don't have to tell me anything if you don't want to. I know that. But you should know what's going on. Yes, some of the people I work with raid the parties. And you know, sometimes I feel like I should do it, too. I mean, guys like JT are making a killing off people. And for what? Peddling stuff that kills. But it's not for me. I don't participate. I just don't see the point."
"I've ridden along with JT and a few of his friends in their sports cars," I said. "Sometimes a cop will pull us over for no reason, and then he asks to see a paycheck stub, right?"
"Yeah, how did you know I was going to say that?" "Think about how frustrating it is to do policing," Reggie said. "You've been hanging out with these guys. You know that they never hold the cash that they make. They have all these investments in other people's names. So what can we do? We can't arrest their mothers for living in a nice house. But when we stop them in fancy cars, we can legitimately ask whether they stole the car or not. Now, again, I don't do that stuff. But some other people do. But I don't have to carry around a paycheck stub. Why should they?" I knew this was a naive-sounding question, and I was fully aware that there was a big difference between me and the gang members. But because naivete had worked in the past, I stuck with this strategy.
"You are not peddling that shit," Reggie said, stating the obvious. I wasn't sure if his explanation was meant to be sarcastic, whether he was humoring me, or whether he just wanted to make sure I understood precisely the police officer's rationale.
"You aren't making millions by killing people. Sometimes we'll take their car away."
"What do you do with it?" I asked. I knew Reggie didn't believe that the drug dealers were each making millions, but some of their earnings were still sufficiently greater than the cops to make Reggie upset. "A lot of times, we'll sell it at a police auction, and the money goes to charity. I figure it's a way of getting back at those fools." On a few occasions, I'd been riding in a car with some gang members when a cop stopped the car, made everyone get out, and summarily called for a tow truck. On a few other occasions, the cop let the driver keep the car, but took everyone's jewelry and cash. To me, the strangest thing was that the gang members barely protested. It was as if they were playing a life-size board game, the rules of which were well-established and immutable, and on this occasion they'd simply gotten a bad roll of the dice. A few weeks later, Reggie invited me to a Southside bar frequented by black cops.
"I think you're getting a real one-sided view of our work," he said.
His offer surprised me. Reggie was a reserved man, and he rarely introduced me to other police officers, even if they were standing nearby. He preferred to speak with me behind closed doors, in Ms. Bailey's office, inside the Boys and Girls Club, or in his car. We met at the bar on a Saturday afternoon. It was located a few blocks from the precinct and Robert Taylor. It was nondescript on the outside, marked only by some neon beer signs. On either side of it lay fast-food restaurants, liquor stores, and check-cashing shops. Even Reggie didn't know the bar's actual name.
I've been coming here for 15 years, he said, and I never even bothered to ask. He and the other cops just called it the lounge. The place was just as nondescript inside, a long wooden bar, several tables, dim lighting, some bears and bulls posters. It had the feel of a well-worn den in a working-class home. All the patrons were black, and at least in their mid-30s, with a few old-timers nursing an afternoon.